caught him?
It wasn't really hard. We just followed the blood trail. We found him unconscious about 2 blocks away. The big guy, Rocco, he took him out of the basement. He was carrying him.
Rocco Kennard, yeah, we know him.
Gang-affiliated. Luther Ritz, that's his last name, by the way, worked for Rocco. So did Aaron. Rocco probably tried to hide him. When he saw the blood trail, Rocco dumped him in an alley. At least that's our theory. We will need you to identify the guy to make sure he's your shooter.
Okay, Simon said.
How bad was he hit?
He'll live.
Did he say anything on the way in?
Yeah, Fogbenlay said, flashing the smile. He said you and Ingrid shot him.
That's a lie.
That much we know. But I still don't understand what happened. Why did he shoot?
I don't know. We were just talking to Rocco and...
You and your wife?
Yes.
So you two, what, just waltzed into this drug den and started chatting up a gang leader?
Like you said, Detective, what we do to help a loved one.
Fogbenlay seemed to like that answer. Go on.
Simon told him what happened, leaving out only one key aspect.
And then Luther just started firing at you?
Yes.
No warning.
None.
There you go.
Another flash of teeth.
Occam's razor again.
How so? Simon asked.
Rocco is a drug dealer. Luther and Aaron both worked for him. That's a world loaded with violence. Aaron ends up dead, Luther shoots at you guys. Speaking of which, who shot Luther?
A man plopped down in the molded yellow seat across from them. He was holding a bandage on his head. Blood oozed through the gauze.
Simon.
What?
Your wife is hit with a bullet. You dive to cover her. Luther is going to finish you off. So who stopped him?
I didn't see anyone, he said.
Fogbenlay heard something in his tone. I didn't ask if you saw anyone. I asked who saved you from Luther.
But just then Anya came sprinting into the room. Simon stood as his daughter wrapped her arms around him, nearly knocking him over. He closed his eyes and held her close, willing the tears to stay back. Anya buried her face in his chest.
Mom,
she muffled cried. He almost said, it's going to be okay, or she'll be fine, but he saw no reason to tell more lies. His eyes opened. Ivan crossed the room and kissed his cheek as he still held Anya. Robert is on his way to get Sam, she said.
Thank you.
Then a man in hospital scrubs came into the room.
Simon Green?
Anya slowly released her grip and freed her father. Right here. Follow me, please. The doctor will see you now.
Chapter 12.
You often hear that a physician's bedside manner is more or less irrelevant. The theory seems to suggest that you just want someone who coldly, mechanically, robotically does the job, who doesn't get distracted by emotion, who lives by that old saw that you'd rather have a surgeon who cuts straight and cares less. Ingrid, Simon knew, believed the opposite. You want a real person, a caring, empathic person, to be your physician. You want a person who sees you as a fellow human being, who is scared and hurting and in need of reassurance and comfort. It was a responsibility Ingrid took very seriously. When a parent brought their child to see her,
well, step back and think about it.
When are you ever more vulnerable? You're stressed, you're terrified, you're confused. Physicians who do not understand that, who act as though you are an anatomical object in need of repair like a MacBook visiting the Genius Bar, are going to not only make the experience more miserable, but they will miss something in the diagnosis. Sometimes, like right now, you are scared and hurting, and stressed and terrified and confused as you take a seat across from a physician who speaks words that will change your life like no others. They could be the worst words in the world, or the best words, or, as in this case, somewhere in between. So Ingrid would really like Dr. Heather Grew,
who oozed both exhaustion and empathy. Gru tried to break it down, aiming for a combination of real-world terminology and medical jargon. Simon focused on the bottom line. Ingrid was still alive. Barely. She was in a coma. The next 24 hours would be crucial. Simon nodded along, but somewhere the doctor's words had untethered him. He was trying to hold on, but he was floating away. Yvonne, who sat next to him, remained firmly grounded. She asked follow-up questions, probably good ones, but they didn't change the meaning or clarify the murky diagnosis. This is another thing you learn about doctors. We may think they are gods sometimes, but the limits of what they know or can do are both astounding and humbling. They were closely monitoring Ingrid's condition, but there was nothing to do right now but wait. Dr. Gru rose and extended her hand. Simon rose and shook it. So did Yvonne. There were no visitors allowed yet, so they stumbled back down the corridor toward the waiting room. Fogbenle cut Simon off and pulled him aside. "I need something from you," Fogbenle said. Simon, still reeling, managed to nod. "Okay. I need you to look at something." He handed Simon a sheet of cardboard with 6 photographs on it. 3 in the top row, 3 on the bottom. They were all headshots, and underneath each headshot was a number. "I want you to study this carefully and tell me if..." "Number 5, Simon said. "Let me finish. I want you to study this carefully and tell me if you recognize any of these men." "I recognize number 5. "How do you know number 5? "He's the man who shot my wife." Fogbenle nodded. "I'd like you to make a formal ID in person. This," Simon pointed to the cardboard sheet, "isn't enough." "I think it would also be better to do it in person." "I don't want to leave my wife right now." "You don't have to. The suspect is here too, recovering from the gunshot. Come on." Fogbenle started down the corridor. Simon looked back at Yvonne, who nodded for him to go. The walk wasn't far, just to the end of the corridor. "Did you catch Rocco, too?" Simon asked.
"We brought him in, yeah."
"What did he say?"
"You and your wife came into his establishment.
He had his back turned. There were gunshots. You ran."
"He has no idea who fired or who got shot or any of that."
"That's bullshit."
"Really?
Rocco, a leading drug dealer, is lying to us? Wow, I for one am shocked." "Did you ask him about my daughter?"
"Doesn't know her. White girls all look the same to me," he said, "especially junkies."
Simon didn't wince. "Can you hold him?"
"On what charge?" "You yourself said Rocco never attacked you, right?"
"Right. Luther was the one who pulled the trigger. Speaking of which..." He stopped in front of a room with a uniformed cop sitting by the door.
"Hey, Tony," Fogbenle said.
Tony, the guard, looked at Simon.
"Who's this?" "The Vic's husband."
"Oh." Tony the guard nodded toward Simon. "Sorry." "Thanks."
"He's here to make an ID," Fogbenle said.
"Assume the perp is still out?"
"Nah, he's awake."
"Since when?
5, 10 minutes ago?"
Fogbenle turned to Simon.
"Probably not a good idea to do this now."
"Why not?"
"Protocol. Most witnesses are scared to be face to face with the perp."
Simon frowned. "Let's just do this."
"That doesn't bother you that he'll see you?"
"He saw me when he shot my wife. You think I care?"
Fogbenle shrugged a "suit yourself" and pushed open the door. A television played something in Spanish.
Luther sat up in bed, his shoulder wrapped. He gave Simon a scowl and said, "What's he doing in here?"
"Oh, so you know this man?" Fogbenle asked.
Luther's eyes shifted left and right. Fogbenle turned to Simon.
"Mr. Green?"
"Yes. He's the man who shot my wife." "That's a lie!"
"You're certain?" Fogbenle asked.
"Yes," Simon said. "I'm certain." "They shot me!" Luther shouted.
"Did they, Luther?"
"Yeah, he's a liar!"
"Where did they shoot you exactly?"
"In the shoulder!"
"No, Luther, I mean geographical location."
"Huh?"
Fogbenle rolled his eyes. "The place, Luther."
"Oh, In that basement, in Rocco's lot.
So why did we find you hiding in an alley 2 blocks away?
You could see the dumb stamped all over him. I ran from him.
And hid in an alley even when the police came searching for you?
Hey, I don't like cops, that's all.
Great. Thanks for confirming that you were at the shooting scene, Luther. Really helps us wrap this all up.
I didn't shoot nobody. You got no proof.
Do you own a gun, Luther?
No.
Never fired one?
A gun?
He got a cagey look.
Maybe once, like years ago.
Man, Luther, don't you watch TV?
What?
Like every cop show. Luther looked confused.
There's always the part where some moronic perp says, I never fired the gun, you know, like you just did. And then the cop says, they ran a gunshot residue test. This ringing any bells, Luther?
And they find residue, usually in the form of gunpowder particles, on the moronic perp's hands and clothes.
Luther's face lost color.
And see, once they have all that, the cops, that would be me, have the guy dead to rights. We have witnesses and gun residue and scientific proof our moronic perp is a liar. It's over for him. He usually confesses and tries to cut a deal.
Luther sat back and blinked.
You want to tell us why you did it?
I didn't do it.
Fagbenlay sighed. You're really boring us now.
Why don't you ask him why?
Luther asked.
Pardon? Luther tilted his chin toward Simon. Ask him.
Simon took deep breaths. He'd been blocking since he'd entered the room, but now it all came crashing down on him. Ingrid, the woman he loved like no other, was nearby in this very building, clinging to life because of this piece of shit. Without conscious thought, Simon took a step toward the bed, raising his hands to throttle the useless turd, this nothing, this worthless dung, who had tried to snuff out the life of such a wonderful, vibrant being. Fagbenlay put an arm out to keep Simon in check, more a mental blockade than a physical one. He met Simon's eyes and gave an understanding but firm shake of the head.
What should I ask him, Luther? Fagbenlay asked.
What were they two doing at Rocco's, huh? Let's say I did do it, not really, but like pretend, like, what's the word, hypodermically? Let's say I did it.
Fagbenlay tried not to frown. Go for it.
Maybe Rocco needs protection.
Why would Rocco need protection?
Don't know. I'm talking hypodermically.
So Rocco told you to shoot Dr. Green?
Doctor?
He sat up, wincing.
What are you talking about? I didn't shoot no doctor. You ain't pinning that on me.
He pointed at Simon.
I just shot his old lady.
Simon didn't know whether he should burst out punching or laughing. Again, the sheer outrage of the situation, that even this worthless slice of nothing has the power to destroy something as vital and cherished and loved as Ingrid, consumed him, making him realize that there was nothing just in this world, no control, no center force, just random chaos. He wanted to kill this punk, stomp him out like the bug that he was, except no bug could ever be this callous and harmful. So yes, stomp out this nothing for the good of mankind. Much gained, nothing lost. And yet he suddenly felt exhausted by the notion that in the end, there was no point in doing even that. It was all a big fucking joke.
I was just protecting my boss, Luther said. Self-defense, you know what I'm saying?
Simon felt his phone vibrate. He glanced at the screen. It was from Yvonne. We can see Ingrid now. When Simon first entered her room, when he first saw Ingrid on that bed, stiller than sleep, tubes everywhere, gurgling machines, when he first saw all of that, his knees buckled and his body fell toward the floor. He didn't catch himself. He probably could have reached out and grabbed the wheelchair accessibility bar on his right. But he didn't. He let himself land, and land hard, and let himself have the silent scream, that moment, because he knew that he needed it.
When that was over, he rose, and there were no more tears. He sat next to Ingrid and held her hand and talked to her. He didn't will her to live or tell her how much he loved her or any of that. If Ingrid could hear, she wouldn't want those words. She wasn't big on melodrama, for one thing. But more than that, she wouldn't want him expressing thoughts like this when she couldn't reciprocate or at least comment. Declarations of love or loss with no response were meaningless to her. It was like playing catch with yourself. It had to go two ways. So he talked about general stuff, his work, her work, the remodeling of the kitchen that might one day happen, or more likely not, about politics and the past, and a few favorite memories he knew she liked to bathe in. That was also Ingrid. She liked when he repeated certain stories. She was the kind who listened deeply with her entire being, and a smile would come to her lips, and he could see that she was back there with him, reliving the moment with a clarity few people could experience. But of course, there was no smile on her face today. At some point, Simon couldn't say how much time had passed, Yvonne put her hand on his shoulder. "Tell me what happened," she said. "Everything." So he did. Yvonne kept her eyes on her sister's face. She and Ingrid had taken such different paths, and maybe that explained the rift. Ingrid had chosen something of a high life to start, the modeling, the travel, some experimentation with drugs that oddly made her less sympathetic to Paige, not more. Whereas Yvonne had always been more the dutiful type A daughter who studied hard and loved her parents and stayed on the straight and narrow. In the end, Ingrid had discovered, as she put it, that searching the whole world just makes you find home. She'd come back and done a year of what was called post-baccalaureate at Bryn Mawr College, so as to cram in all her pre-med requirements. With the sort of determination and single focus that Yvonne would undoubtedly admire in another person, Ingrid excelled through med school, residency, and internship. "You can't stay here," Yvonne said when he finished. "What are you talking about?" "I'll sit with Ingrid." "But you can't just sit here, Simon. You have to go find Paige." "I can't leave now." "You have to. You have no choice." "We always promised." Simon stopped. He wasn't going to explain to Yvonne what she already knew. He and Ingrid were like one. If one of them got sick, the other was going to be there. That was the rule. That was part of the bargain in all this. Yvonne understood, but she still shook her head. "Ingrid is going to wake up from this. Or she's not. And if she wakes up, she's going to want to see Paige's face." He didn't reply. "You can't find her if you're sitting here. Yvonne, Ingrid would tell you that if she could, Simon. You know this." Ingrid's hand felt lifeless now. No feel of blood pumping through it. Simon stared at his wife, willing her to give him some kind of answer or sign. But she seemed to be growing smaller, fading away right in front of his eyes. This didn't seem to be Ingrid in this bed anymore. Just an empty body, as if her being had already fled the building. He wasn't naive enough to think the sound of Paige's voice could bring Ingrid back, but he sure as shit didn't think him sitting there would do it either. Simon let go of Ingrid's hand. "Before I go, I'll need to—" "I got the kids. I got the business. I got Ingrid. Go." Chapter 13. Night had passed, and it was nearly daybreak when the car dropped Simon back off by those concrete blocks in the Bronx. There was no one on the street, no one awake, anyway. Two guys were sleeping on the sidewalk in front of the overgrown abandoned lot, scant feet from where he and Ingrid had entered, what, just a few hours ago. Someone had hung up police tape, but it had been torn down the middle, flying in the pre-dawn breeze. Simon reached the decrepit four-floor brick tenement house that his daughter had called home.
He headed back inside this time with no hesitation or fear. He started up the stairs but stopped on the second floor rather than heading up to the third. It wasn't quite 6 a.m. Simon hadn't slept, of course. He felt rattled and juiced up on something that he knew would ebb out of him soon. He knocked on the door and waited. He figured that he might be waking him up, but he didn't much care. 10 seconds later, no more, the door opened. Cornelius looked as though he hadn't slept much either. The two men looked at each other for a long moment.
"How is she?" Cornelius asked.
"Critical.
Better come inside."
Simon wasn't sure what he expected when he stepped into Cornelius's apartment, something like the dirty hovel Paige had called home. But the interior was like stepping through a magic portal into another world. The place could have been featured on one of those home TV shows Ingrid loved to watch. Built-in oak bookshelves framed the windows on the far wall. A classic Victorian tufted sofa of green sat to the right. The embroidered accent pillows had botanical themes. Prints of butterflies hung to the left. A chess set sat atop an ornate wood table, and for a moment, Simon could almost see Paige sitting there with Cornelius, the way her brow would furrow, and she'd play with her hair when she concentrated on a move. A cocker spaniel burst around the corner, tail wagging so hard she could barely keep her balance. Cornelius scooped her up and held her close.
"Ah, this here is Chloe."
There were photographs in front of the books on the shelves. Family photographs, lots of them. Simon moved toward them for a better look. He stopped at the first photograph, a standard family shot in front of a rainbow backdrop. A younger Cornelius, a woman who looked to be his wife, and three smiling teenage boys, two of whom were already taller than Cornelius. Cornelius put down the dog and joined him.
"This picture gotta be 8, 10 years old. Me and Tanya, we raised 3 boys here in this apartment. They're grown now. Tanya, she passed 2 years ago. Breast cancer."
"I'm sorry," Simon said.
"Do you want to sit? You look exhausted, man."
"If I sit, I'm afraid I'm not going to get back up."
"Might not be a bad idea. You need some rest if you want to keep going."
"Maybe later." Cornelius placed the family photograph down gently, as though it were exceedingly fragile, and pointed to a portrait of a Marine in uniform.
"This here's Eldon. He's our oldest."
"A Marine?"
"Yes."
"He looks like you."
"That he does."
"You serve, Cornelius?"
"A Marine Corporal, 1st Persian Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm."
Cornelius turned and faced Simon full on.
"You don't seem surprised."
"I'm not." Cornelius rubbed his chin.
"Did you see me?"
"Just a flash."
"But enough to figure it out?"
"I think I would have guessed anyway," Simon said. "I don't know how to thank you."
"Don't. I saw Luther heading in, so I followed him. Should have taken him out before he shot Ingrid.
You saved our lives." Cornelius glanced back over at the family photo, as though the images might impart some kind of wisdom to him.
"So why are you back here?" he asked.
"You know why."
"To find Paige?"
"Yes."
"She went there too, to that basement, same as you."
Cornelius moved toward the far corner.
"I never saw her after that."
"And then Aaron ended up dead."
"Yes."
"Do you think they killed Paige?"
"I don't know."
Cornelius squatted down. He opened a cabinet, revealing a safe.
"But you should be prepared for bad news, no matter how this shakes out."
"I am," Simon said. Cornelius pressed his thumb against the door. Simon heard the beep-beep as the safe read his prints. The door opened.
"And you shouldn't go in this time without backup."
He reached inside and pulled out 2 handguns. He stood up and shut the cabinet. He handed one weapon to Simon and kept the other for himself.
"You don't have to do this," Simon said. "You didn't come here just to thank me, did you?"
"No."
"Let's go find Rocco."
The Judge Lester Patterson Houses was one of the city's oldest and largest low-income housing complexes, featuring 15 monotonous high-rises of tired brick. The complex sat on more than 17 acres and housed more than 1,800 families. Cornelius led the way. The elevators in Building 6 were out of order, so they took the stairs. The hour was early, but the place was alive. The stairwells were filled with laughing kids getting ready for school. Adults began their daily treks to the nearby bus and subway stops for the work commute. Most everyone was leaving, heading down the stairs, so that Cornelius and Simon had to swim upstream, two salmon, on their way to the 8th floor. Rocco's mother and siblings lived in apartment 8C. Two children sprinted out the door, leaving it open. Simon rapped his knuckles on the door, and a woman's voice told him to come in. Simon entered. Cornelius stayed by the door. Rocco rose from a barca lounger and started toward him. Again, Simon was taken aback by the pure size of the man. A woman came out of the kitchen. "Who's this?" she asked. Rocco stared daggers at Simon. "Don't worry about it, Mama."
"Don't tell me not to worry about it. This is my house."
"I got it, Mama. He's just leaving." Rocco stepped right up to Simon, spreading out to his full size. Simon was eye to eye with his pectorals. "Aren't you?" Simon tilted so he could see past Rocco, which was no easy task. "I'm looking for my daughter," he said to Rocco's mother. "I think your son may know where she is."
"Rocco?"
"Don't listen to him, Mama." But she wasn't having any of that. As his mother strode toward him, the big men seemed to wither.
"Do you know where this man's daughter is?"
"I don't, Mama." He sounded like a 10-year-old now.
"I'm telling the truth."
Now she turned on Simon. "What makes you think he knows, mister?"
"Let me talk to him for a second, Mama."
Rocco started moving them toward the door.
"I got this."
Rocco used his bulk to shove Simon back into the corridor, followed him out, and closed the door behind him.
"Not cool, man, coming to my mama's."
He spotted Cornelius.
"What the fuck are you doing here?"
"Just helping out."
Rocco snapped his fingers and pointed at him.
"Now I get it. You're the one who sent him to me in the first place. Get the fuck out of here, both of you."
Simon didn't move.
"Rocco."
The big man looked down at him.
"What?"
"My wife is in a coma fighting to survive. She got shot in your basement by your man. My daughter is missing. The last place anyone saw her was also in your basement." Simon didn't flinch or waver or even move. "I'm not going anywhere until you tell me everything you know."
"You think I'm scared of you?"
"You should be," Cornelius said.
"Why's that?"
"Look at him, Rocco. He's a desperate man. You smart enough to know it don't pay to mess with a desperate man." Rocco did indeed look at him. Simon held his gaze. "I'll tell the police you ordered Luther to shoot us," Simon said.
"What?
You know that isn't true. You called out Luther's name
to stop him, man. I didn't want him to shoot."
"I don't know that. I think it was an order. I think you told him to shoot us."
"Ah, I see."
Rocco spread his hands. He looked at Simon and then at Cornelius.
"So that's how it is it?"
Cornelius shrugged. "I just want to find my daughter," Simon said. Rocco did a let-me-think-about-it head roll.
"Okay, fine. But then I want you gone."
Simon nodded.
"Yeah, she came to me. Paige, I mean. She came to the basement. I could see right away that someone had beaten her up."
"Did she say who?"
"I didn't have to ask. I knew."
"Aaron." Rocco didn't bother replying. "So why did Luther shoot at us?"
"Because he's crazy."
Simon shook his head. "There's got to be more to it than that."
"I didn't tell him to do it."
"Who did?"
"Look, man, the business I'm in, it isn't an easy one. Always someone trying to move in on us. Aaron, yeah, he was a shitbag, but he was one of us. We figure a rival, shall we say, enterprise, took him out. Maybe the Fidels?"
"Fidels." Cornelius said, "Cuban gang." And even in the middle of all this, with his wife fighting for her life and his daughter God knows where, Simon laughed out loud. The sound echoed in the corridor. People turned and stared.
"You're kidding me."
"I'm not."
"A Cuban gang called the Fidels?"
Cornelius let a smile hit his lips.
The leader's name is Castro.
Oh, you're making that up.
Swear to God.
Simon spun back toward Rocco. Why did Paige come to you after this beating?
Why do you think?
For a fix, Simon said.
Did you give it to her?
She didn't have any money.
Is that a no?
Well, I'm not a charity, Rocco said.
So what next?
She left, man. Next thing I know, Aaron is dead.
Do you think Paige did it?
Smart money is on the Fidels, he said, but yeah, I think there's a chance Paige killed him. Or maybe you did it, man. Maybe that's what Luther was thinking. Luther was there when Paige came in. Think about it.
Let's say I'm a father. If some dude hurt my daughter the way Aaron hurt yours, I get revenge.
So maybe that's your play.
What's my play?
Maybe you killed Aaron. And now you're looking for your daughter to complete the rescue.
That's not my play, Simon said.
But he kind of wished that it was. Rocco was right. If someone hurts your daughter, a father has an obligation to stop him no matter what.
Simon hadn't. He let Paige slip away, trying to throw her useless lifelines instead of doing what a man should do.
Anything. To rescue his child. Protect her. Save her.
Some father he'd turned out to be.
She's probably around here somewhere, Rocco said. You can look for her, man. I can't blame you for trying.
But she's a junkie. Even if you find her, this story won't have a happy ending.
Cornelius led the way back to his apartment. When he closed the door behind them, Simon reached into his coat pocket and took out the gun.
Here, Simon said, holding it out toward him. Keep it.
You sure?
I'm sure, Cornelius said.
Do you think Rocco will be able to find her?
With that reward money?
Simon had ended up making a simple offer to Rocco. Find Paige and get $50,000.
Yeah, Cornelius said. If she's still down here, he'll find her.
There was a knock on Cornelius's door. Put that gun back in your pocket, Cornelius whispered. Then raising his voice, who's there?
What sounded like a little old lady with an accent, Polish, Russian, Eastern European maybe, said,
it's Lizzie, Mr. Cornelius.
Cornelius opened the door. The woman was, as voice advertised, small and old. She wore a strange white gown of some sort, long and flowing, almost something you'd wear to bed. Her gray hair ran down her back, loose and unkempt. The hair seemed to be swaying from a breeze, even though there was none.
Something I can do for you, Miss Sobeck? Cornelius said.
The old woman peered around Cornelius with her huge eyes and spotted Simon.
Who are you? She asked him.
My name is Simon Green, ma'am.
Paige's father, Cornelius added.
The old woman gave Simon a look so heavy, he almost stepped back.
You can still save her, you know.
Her words chilled him.
Do you know where Paige is? Simon asked.
Miss Sobeck shook her head, the long gray hair dancing across her face like a bead curtain.
But I know what she is.
Cornelius cleared his throat, trying to move this along.
Did you want something, Miss Sobeck?
Someone is upstairs.
Upstairs?
On the third floor. A woman. She just sneaked into Paige's apartment. I thought you'd want to know.
Did you recognize her?
Never seen her before.
Thank you, Miss Sobeck. I'll go check right now.
Cornelius and Simon stepped back into the corridor. Miss Sobeck hurried away.
Why did she come to you with this? Simon asked, following him down the corridor.
I'm not just a tenant.
You're the super?
I'm the owner.
They headed up the stairs and down the hall. The yellow tape on the apartment door, blocking off the murder scene, Simon reminded himself, was torn. Cornelius reached out for the knob. Simon realized that he had, intentionally, subconsciously, put his hand on the gun in his pocket. Is that what happens when you carry? Is it always there by your side like some kind of pacifier that calms or gives comfort in stressful situations? Cornelius flung the door open. A woman stood there. If she was startled by their interruption, she was doing a good job of keeping it to herself. She was short and squat, maybe Latina, with a blue blazer and jeans. She spoke first.
Are you Simon Green?
Who are you?
My name is Elena Ramirez. I'm a private detective. I need to talk to your daughter.
Elena Ramirez showed them a fancy embossed business card, a private investigator's license of some kind, and an ID showing she was a retired FBI agent. They were all back in Cornelius's apartment now. The two men sat in leather armchairs while Elena Ramirez took the green tufted sofa.
So where is your daughter, Mr. Green? She asked.
I don't understand. Your card says you're from Chicago.
That's correct.
So why do you want to talk to my daughter?
It involves a case I'm working on, Ramirez said.
What case?
That I can't say.
Miss Ramirez?
Please, call me Elena.
Elena, I'm not really up for games. I don't care what your case is, and I don't have any reason to be cagey, so I'm going to be forthright, and I hope you will be too. I don't know where my daughter is. That's why I'm here. I'm trying to locate her. I basically have no leads, other than the fact that she's probably getting high within a 1 square mile radius of where we are now. Following me so far?
You bet,
Elena said. So now you come along, a private eye from Chicago, no less, and want to talk to my daughter.
I'd love you to talk to her. There's nothing I'd like more, in fact, so maybe we can help each other out by cooperating.
Simon's phone buzzed. He had it in his hand, constantly checking for any text updates, feeling that phantom vibration thing every 10 seconds. This one was real. Yvonne texted, stabilizing, which doctor says is good, moved to a private room, still in a coma, Sam and Anya with us.
Just to make sure I'm following, Elena Ramirez said, your daughter is missing, is that correct?
Simon still had his eyes on the phone's screen.
Yes. Since when?
There was nothing to gain by being coy. Since her boyfriend was murdered. Elena Ramirez took her time, crossed her arms, thought it over. Simon said,
Elena, I'm looking for a missing person, too.
Who?
A 24-year-old male who disappeared from the Chicago area.
Cornelius spoke for the first time since they sat down.
How long has he been missing?
Since last Thursday.
Simon asked, who is it?
I can't divulge the name.
Ugh, for crying out loud, Elena, if your missing 24-year-old is someone my daughter knows, maybe we can help.
Elena Ramirez considered that for a moment.
His name is Henry Thorpe.
Simon picked up his phone and started typing.
What are you doing? She asked.
I don't recognize the name. I'm checking with my son and other daughter. They'd have a better handle on Paige's friends.
I don't think Paige and Henry were friends.
So what is the connection between them?
Elena Ramirez shrugged. That's part of why I'm here. To try to find out. Without going into full detail, it seems that not long before he vanished, Henry Thorpe was in touch with either your daughter or perhaps her boyfriend, Aaron Corval.
In touch how? She took out a small notebook, licked her fingers, started paging through it.
There was a phone call first, from your daughter's phone to Henry's. This was 2 weeks ago. Then there were texts for a while, followed by emails.
What did the texts and emails say?
I don't know. The texts are on their phones, I guess. We can't access them. The emails were all deleted. We can see some were sent, but nothing beyond that.
What makes you think these communications are important?
I don't know that they are, Mr. Green. This is what I do. When someone goes missing, I look for anomalies, something that doesn't fit into their normal routine.
And these emails and texts?
Anomalies. Can you think of any reason Henry Thorpe, a 24-year-old man from Chicago, would suddenly be in touch with your daughter or Aaron Corval?
Simon didn't really have to think about it long. Does Henry Thorpe have a history of drug use?
Some.
It could be that.
Could be, Elena said. But you can buy drugs in Chicago.
Could be something more professional in that respect.
Could be, but I don't think so, do you?
No, Simon said. And either way, my daughter and your client are both missing.
Yes.
So what can I do to help? Simon asked.
The first thing I asked myself was why the communications moved from texting by phone to emails via a computer.
And
how into drugs were they, your daughter and her boyfriend?
Simon saw no reason to lie.
Very.
Cornelius snapped his fingers, getting it.
Paige probably sold her phone to raise cash for a fix.
He turned to Simon. Happens all the time down here.
That phone is no longer active, Elena agreed, so that would be my theory, too.
Simon wasn't so sure.
So Paige moved from using a phone to using a computer?
Yes.
So where is the computer now?
Probably sold that, too, Cornelius said.
That would be my guess, Elena said. She could have taken it with her when she vanished, I guess, or the killer could have stolen it. But the key question is, how did she get the computer in the first place? She couldn't have bought it, right?
Unlikely, Simon said. I mean, if she was selling her phone to buy drugs, why would she spend the money on a computer?
Which means she probably stole it.
Simon just let that sit there. His daughter, junkie, selling her own stuff, thief, and what else?
Are you good with computers, Mr. Green?
Simon, and no.
If you know what you're doing, like my tech guy, Lou, you can check an IP address, Elena said. Sometimes you can track the computer down to a town or a street or even an individual.
Was Lou able to figure out who owned her computer?
No, Elena said. But it came from Amherst, Massachusetts. More specifically, the campus of Amherst College. Doesn't your son go there?
Chapter 14. Anya was asleep in one of those yellow molded chairs when Simon and Elena arrived in the hospital waiting room. Her head rested on her Uncle Robert's bowling ball of a shoulder. Robert, Yvonne's husband, was a big, boisterous man, thick all over, a mostly bald ex-football player with a heart-on-his-sleeve charm. He was a great litigator. Juries loved his winning smile, his every-guy banter that masked a nimble legal mind, his larger-than-life pace during a cross-examination, and other than Yvonne, Robert happened to be Simon's closest friend. Robert gently moved Anya so that he could stand without waking her. He greeted Simon with a monster bear hug. Robert was good with the bear hugs, and for a moment, Simon closed his eyes and took it in.
You okay?
No, didn't think so. The two men let go. Both looked down at the sleeping Anya.
They won't let anyone under 18 in Ingrid's room, Robert explained.
So Sam is...
He and Yvonne are in with her, yeah. Room 717.
Robert glanced a who's this toward Elena Ramirez. Simon figured that she could explain, so he patted Robert's shoulder, thanked him, and headed toward room 717. Cornelius had stayed at home. There was nothing more for him to do. He had done more than enough already, and he felt as though his time might be better used if he stayed in Mott Haven as eyes on the ground.
But if you need me, Cornelius had added, as they exchanged phone information.
Simon opened the door to Ingrid's room. The sounds got to him first, those damn beeping machines and sucking sounds and whatever other goddamn clanks signaled the direct opposite of warmth and care. His son, his beautiful 18-year-old boy Sam, sat in the chair next to his mother's bed. He turned toward his father, his face soaked from tears. Sam was always an emotional child, what Ingrid lovingly called an easy cry, like his father. When Simon's mother died 3 years ago, Sam had cried for hours straight, with zero let-up, just sobbing and sobbing, and Simon couldn't believe that the boy could do this, just keep sobbing full throttle, without passing out from sheer exhaustion. You couldn't comfort Sam when he was like that. As emotional as he could be, physical contact of any kind made it worse. He needed to be alone, he'd tell them. If you tried to stop him or comfort him in any way, it backfired. Even as a small child, Sam would look up through pleading eyes and say, "Just let me get it out, okay?" Yvonne stood by the window. She gave Simon a half-hearted smile. Simon crossed the room. He put a hand on his son's shoulder and bent down to kiss his wife's cheek. Ingrid looked worse to him, colorless, fading, like this whole thing was one of those scenes in a movie where death is battling life, and right now death had the upper hand.
He felt a hand reach into his chest and twist his heart. He looked back over at Yvonne and signaled with a glance toward the door that he needed her to leave. Yvonne got the message right away. Without another word, she slipped out of the room. Simon grabbed a chair and pulled it up next to Sam. Sam wore a red T-shirt with a Sriracha hot chili sauce logo on it. Sam loved logo tees. Ingrid had bought it for him 2 weeks ago, after Sam had told them that the food at college was okay, but he had discovered that putting Sriracha sauce on everything made it better. Ingrid had dutifully gone online, found a Sriracha T-shirt, and shipped it up to him. You okay? Which was a dumb thing for Simon to say, but what else? Silent tears still cascaded down his son's face when Simon said those two words. Sam's face tightened, as though holding back a fresh surge. Sam was so happy up at Amherst. Where Paige had been slightly homesick at college, why the hell hadn't they paid more attention to that? Why had they listened to everyone's unsolicited advice to give it time and not be so available to her? Sam took to freshman campus life immediately. Everyone knew that he encountered was the coolest person in the whole world. His roommate, Carlos, a slacker dude from Austin who sported a soul patch, was even cooler than that. Sam right away signed up for clubs and intramural sports and academic groups. Ingrid would probably be annoyed that Simon had snatched him away from all that. Sam kept his eyes on his mother.
What happened?
What did your aunt and uncle tell you?
Just that Mom had been shot. They said I'd have to wait for you.
Yvonne and Robert had done the right thing yet again. You know who Aaron is, right?
That guy, Paige?
Yes. He was murdered. Sam blinked. And Paige has disappeared.
I don't understand.
They lived together in the Bronx. Your mom and I went down to see if we could find her. That's when she got shot. He filled his son in on the details, not stopping, not taking a breath, not letting up even when Sam started to go pale and his blinking got worse. At some point, Sam said,
"Do you think Paige did it? Do you think she killed Aaron?"
That stopped Simon cold. "Why would you ask that?" Sam just shrugged. "I need to ask you something, Sam." Sam's eyes wandered back to his mother's face. "Have you seen Paige recently?" He didn't reply. "Sam, it's important."
"Yes,"
he said in a soft voice.
"I saw her."
"When?" He wouldn't take his eyes off his mother. "Sam!"
"2 weeks ago, maybe."
That made no sense. Sam was at school 2 weeks ago. There had been one break in the school year, but he was having so much fun on campus he didn't want to leave. Unless that was a lie. Unless he really didn't love school, or damned Sriracha hot sauce, or Carlos, or the intramural sports, or any of that. "Where?" Simon asked.
"She came to Amherst."
"Paige came to your campus?" He nodded.
"Peter Pan bus lines. It's $24 from Port Authority."
"Did she come up alone?" He nodded.
"Did you know she was coming up?"
"No.
She didn't tell me. She just showed up."
Simon tried to envision this. That catalog picture-ready college quad with healthy-looking students playing frisbee or lounging with their books in the sun being infiltrated by one who would have belonged there as much as any of them a year ago, but who is now a horrible warning, like that wrecked car a police station keeps around to teach kids not to drink and drive. Unless... "How did she look?" Simon asked.
"The same as in that video."
The words stomped out his small flame of hope. "Did she tell you why she came up?"
"She said she needed to get away from Aaron."
"Did she tell you why?" Sam shook his head. "So what happened?"
"She asked if she could crash with me for a few days."
"You didn't tell us?" His eyes stayed on Ingrid.
"She asked me not to."
Simon wanted to say something more about that, about not trusting his parents, but now was not the time. "Your roommate didn't mind her staying?"
"Carlos? He thought it would be cool. Like she was some school project to help the underserved or something."
"How long did she stay?" His voice was soft.
"Not very."
"How long, Sam?"
The tears started pushing through his eyes again. Sam.
Long enough to clean us out,
he said. The tears came, flowing down, but his voice remained clear.
Paige slept on Carlos's blow-up mattress on the floor. We all fell asleep. When we woke up, she was gone. So was our stuff.
What did she take?
Our wallets, our laptops. Carlos had a diamond stud.
How could you have not told me? He hated the irritation in his voice.
Sam.
He didn't reply.
Did Carlos tell his parents?
No.
I had some money. I'm trying to make him whole.
Tell me how much, and we'll make him whole now. And what about you?
I called your office, Sam said. I told Emily I lost the credit card. She sent me another.
Simon recalled that now. He hadn't thought twice about it. Visa cards were lost or stolen all the time.
I'm using the computers in the library for now. It's not a big deal.
How could you not tell me? Which again was dumb to harp on, but he couldn't stop himself. His son's face collapsed.
It's my fault, Sam said.
What?
No, if I had told you...
Nothing, Sam. It wouldn't have changed a thing.
Is Mom going to die?
No.
You don't know that.
Which was true enough. He didn't protest or say any more lies. No point. The lies would aggravate rather than comfort. He glanced toward the door. Yvonne watched them from the little window in the door. Simon went over, and again, when you're this close to someone, when you spend as much time together as he and Yvonne, you just read their mind. So Simon left the room, and Yvonne took over. He found Elena Ramirez playing with her phone at the end of the corridor.
Tell me,
she said. He did.
So that explains Paige using the laptop, Elena said.
So what now? Simon asked.
Elena actually managed a smile. You think we're a team?
I think we can help each other.
I agree. I think we need to find the connections.
Elena played with her phone some more.
I'm sending you the details on Aaron's family. They are having some kind of memorial service for him in the morning. Maybe you should be there. Maybe Paige will show. Look for someone hiding nearby. If not, talk to the family. See if you can figure out how Aaron might know Henry Thorpe.
Okay, Simon said. What will you be doing?
Visiting someone else Henry Thorpe contacted.
Who? Don't have a name, Elena said, only a location. Where?
A tattoo parlor in New Jersey.
Chapter 15. The Corval Inn and Family Tree Farm was located in Far East Connecticut, near the Rhode Island border. Simon arrived at 8:30 a.m. The memorial service for Aaron, according to Elena Ramirez, was to start at 9. The inn was a white federal-style farmhouse with tasteful additions on both sides. Green wicker rocking chairs lined the wraparound porch. A sign read, "Family-owned since 1893." Pure New England postcard. On the right, a bus let out tourists for hayrides. The barn in the back was a rootin' tootin' petting zoo, promising petting interactions with goats, sheep, alpacas, and chickens, though Simon wondered how specifically you went about petting a chicken. At Christmas time, visitors chopped down their own Christmas trees. In October, they set up the place as the Haunted Farm, complete with the haunted maze, the haunted silo, the haunted hayride, keyword haunted, driven by the haunted headless horseman. There was also seasonal pumpkin and apple picking. You could make your own cider in the small cabin on the right. Simon parked the car and headed toward the inn's front door. An ornate sign by the door said, "Inn guests only." Simon ignored it and entered the foyer. The decor was of the period and more formal than Simon would have expected. Cherrywood chairs with fanned Windsor backs sat on either side of mahogany settees with winged paw feet. The grandfather clock stood next to the oversized fireplace like a sentinel. One mahogany break front displayed fine china, the other leather-bound books. There were old oil portraits of stern-looking, hearty men, past patriarchs of the Corval family.
"May I help you?"
The woman behind the desk smiled at him. She wore a blouse checkered in the same design as those Italian restaurants that were trying too hard to be authentic. He wondered whether this woman was Aaron's mother, but then he followed the old oil portraits until he reached a framed photograph of a smiling couple circling 60 behind her head. A plaque under the photograph read, "The Corvals, Wiley and Enid." Simon said, "I'm here for the memorial service." The woman gave him suspicious, if not stink eye.
"May I ask your name?"
"Simon Green."
"I don't know you, Mr. Green."
He nodded. "I knew Aaron."
"You knew Aaron?"
she said, her voice tinged with disbelief.
"And you're here to pay your respects?"
Simon didn't bother to reply. The woman took out a pamphlet and opened it carefully. Her reading glasses were dangling from a chain. She put them on the end of her nose.
"You head back behind the barn, turn right here. You'll see the corn maze. Don't go in it. Twice this week we've had to send in employees to get people out. Walk around here."
She pointed on the map.
"There's a path into the woods. Head down it. You'll see a green arrow on a tree pointing right. That's for the hikers. You instead turn left."
"Complicated," Simon said.
She handed him the pamphlet and frowned at him. "This lobby is only for guests staying at the inn.
And subtle." He thanked her and headed back outside. The hayride was getting underway, a tractor pulling a bunch of people at much too slow a pace. Everyone was smiling, though they looked pretty uncomfortable. A family, man, woman, daughter, son, waved at him in unison. He waved back, and boom, he dropped back in time to taking the kids apple picking in Chester, just north of the New Jersey border. It had been a glorious autumn day, and yes, he remembered putting Paige on his shoulders so that she could reach a higher branch. But what he remembered most right now, as he stood there and tried not to stare at this happy, innocent, blissfully ignorant family, was the way Ingrid looked, in her dark flannel shirt tucked into thin-legged blue jeans and high boots. He had just turned toward her, Paige giggling on his shoulders, and Ingrid had smiled back at him, tucking her hair behind her ear. And even now, just thinking about how their eyes met on that day, Simon could feel his knees give way just a little bit. He grabbed his phone and stared at the screen for a few seconds, willing it to give him good news. It didn't. He followed the route past the petting zoo barn. The chickens were loose. One ran up to him, stopped, looked at him. Simon was tempted to try to pet it. A man dressed in farmer overalls was giving a demonstration involving eggs and an incubator. The corn stalks at the maze were 10 feet high. There was a line to get in and a sign telling visitors that the maze's theme for this year was the 50 states, find them all. He spotted the walking path, took it as told to the green arrow, turned left when the arrow wanted him to turn right. The woods grew thicker. He looked back to where he'd started, but he couldn't see the clearing anymore. Simon kept going, the path sloping down now, steeper and steeper. He heard what sounded like running water in the distance, a brook, maybe. The path veered right. The trees in front of him thinned until Simon found himself in a clearing. It was a perfect square, the clearing made by man rather than natural design. A low wooden picket fence, a foot high, no more, formed the perimeter around small tombstones. A family plot. Simon stopped. Behind the clearing was indeed a roaring brook and a faded teakwood bench. Simon didn't think the dead cared much, but for the living, this would be a zen place to grieve and meditate on those you lost. A man Simon recognized as Wiley Corval, Aaron's father, stood alone, staring down at a newer tombstone. Simon waited. Wiley Corval eventually lifted his head toward him.
"Who are you?"
he asked.
"My name is Simon Green."
Wiley Corval looked a question at him.
"I'm Paige's father."
"Did she do it?"
Simon said nothing.
"Did she kill my son?"
"No."
"How do you know for sure?"
"I don't."
The man was about to bury his son. It wasn't the time to lie.
"I could tell you my daughter is not a killer, but
That's not going to offer you much comfort, is it?
Wiley Corval just stared at him. But I don't think it was Paige. The death, it was violent.
Do you know the details?
Yes.
I don't think she could do